Ready? Bell, settle down. You ready? Ready, Pepper? Beautiful girl. Om Sahana Bhavatu, Sahana Bhunaktu, Saha Viryam Karavavahai, Tejasvinavaditamastu Ma Vidvishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Okay, so we are the first chapter, the first section with the third chapter, verse 12. And for those of you who are using my printout, unfortunately this is the last verse I printed out, but some of you have the book, right? If you don't have the book, you can just listen. So this is verse 12. Does everybody have it? Asha Sarvesha. Asha Sarvesha Bhuteshu. Esha sarveshu bhuteshu gudatmana prakashate gudatmana prakashate drishyate tragraya bhudhya drishyate tragraya bhudhya sukshmaya sukshma darshibhi sukshmaya sukshma darshibhi eshaha sarveshu bhuteshu gudha atma na prakashate drishyate drishyate tu agriya buddhya sukshmaya sukshma darshibhi. The last two verses we did got to the Paramatma, going in the order of subtlety, going from the sense objects to the sense organs, right? Going from the sense objects to the sense organs, to the mind, to the buddhi, to Hiranyagarbha, and then from Hiranyagarbha to the Mahanatma, to Brahman, to the Purusha. One being more subtle than the other. Having gotten to that subtle, most subtle, what they say, the kashta paragatihi, that which is the most subtle, that is not any longer subject to any type of objectification, right? Then the question is, having arrived at that through this process of discrimination, here, where the Upanishad is just listing these orders of subtlety, then he says this, having, through the orders of subtlety, gotten to that para-atma, that para-gatihi, the self that can, if you do subject-object, everything that can be objectified is going to have an innermost subject, but then that becomes objectified, now there's an innermost subject, that becomes objectified, there's an innermost subject. You get to a point where you're at the bottom line, which is your own being. It can no longer be objectified because then there would have to be another subject. So in the end, that innermost subject, what we call the Paramatma, has to be yourself. Mm. Or there would be somebody internally, experientially, that would be objectifying that experience. And so that's why this drishya viveka, this seer-seeing differentiation, is such a powerful teaching methodology. Because you're actually differentiating your experience, the subject-object experience, your differentiating yourself, the conscious being, from anything that can be objectified. Because as you go along through this process, things that actually can be objectified so that you have a subject-object relationship with, you had taken to be yourself. Like, for instance, I could take myself to be this physical body, but upon analysis, I recognize that this physical body really is objectified by my sense organs, and so it can't be innermost. It can't really be me. I can take it to be in me because it enjoys consciousness. But because it's objectified, I'm going to be the subject, not the object. And so when we go through this seer-seeing process of differentiation, I can say, well, it's because of my sense organs I know the body, but then the sense organs also are known by the mind. And so they become instruments, not me. because I can objectify them. It's the same with all of my thoughts, all of my emotions. I can make a differentiation between the emotional fluctuating thoughts and the that we call the manas, the fluctuating mind, the emotional mind, and the differentiate that between the buddhi, the decisive mind, the mind that has a running commentary on the fluctuating mind. That's what we call the intellect, the buddhi, the one that cares as though the knower. But that buddhi also can be objectified. And so then if it can be objectified, who am I the subject? Right? It has a subject-object relationship with it. So this is called drishya-viveka, the seer seeing differentiation. And that has to be done very thoroughly. Otherwise, the kind of mistaken identification that is caused by this kind of mutual in superimposition has its roots in self-ignorance, right? Because I haven't done the differentiation. I've never done that differentiation. And that means I'm ignorant of myself. Problem is that if I'm ignorant of myself, what would be the prior condition of that? Ignorance, self-ignorance. Because you can't say the prior condition of self, your ignorance is knowledge. You say that self-ignorance is beginningless. So in fact, it's never been done. That viveka has never taken place, because once it takes place, once that discrimination takes place, then it's hard to go back. Right. Once that subject-object differentiation is seen, you can't imagine how you could not have seen that, actually. You can't get back to that type of ajnana. You might behave ignorantly, but you cannot get back. You can't get that total ignorance back where there's no viveka, there's no discrimination between yourself and what you objectify. So, what he's saying now in this verse, and then going into this viveka, this verse number 12, is really talking about this condition of ajnanam, of self-ignorance. So he says, eshaha, this means this purusha, the person, the conscious being, sarveshu bhuteshu, in all beings, so this atma, he says, this atma, the gudatma, so eshaha atma, this self, he says, is guda. It is hidden. It is there hidden in all beings. Guda means hidden. It's like there in the cave of the heart. The self, myself, is there hidden in all beings. And because it's hidden there in all beings, nat prakashate, it doesn't shine, what they mean here, it doesn't shine as itself. It shines. Yourself shines, in this sense, what they mean by prakashate. It doesn't appear as yourself, it appears as me. Like if I were to say, just when we were doing the meditation, you can never negate your own me-ness, I am, or I exist, or I am here, or even if you say, I am this physical body, you know, or if I say, oh, I am happy, or I am sad, or I am tired, this I am, right, is pervasive. You're never going to have an experience where I'm not there. And so in that sense, you always shine. But you don't shine as yourself. When you say, I'm looking at that painting. Oh, I remember when I got that painting. I now become a seer. Right? The I, the me, just naturally assumes seership. If I say, I need to go to the store to pick something up. Now I'm a doer. I'm going to do something. So the me is always being defined by my experiences. There's no viveka. There's no recognition of myself as I am. And so Shankara says here, if I'm the self, it's always hidden as darshana shravanadi karma avidya, by self-ignorance in reference to identifying yourself with all of the things that you're doing, or all of the things that you're experiencing, or identifying yourself in reference to all of your relationships. Like you could say, I am a sister or a mother, or I'm the, you know, the caretaker of my animals, or whatever the relationships I happen to be in, I can identify myself in relationship to all of those relations. I can identify myself in terms of my age or in terms of my gender, or in terms of my my skills, or in terms of my masteries or my jobs or whatever. You never have to worry, you know, about dressing the I. It always comes dressed in something. It happens so automatically that we never even have time to think about, well, who am I that is taking all of these roles? Who is the me that is always there taking on, you know, millions of different roles? In order to have that thought, it's considered, you know, crores of punya, you know, crores and crores of blessings to have the space or the subtlety of mind to even question that, because there's really no reason to. Not really. Because your nature is being continually taken care of situationally. And so that's what's being said here. And all of these beings, the self is Buddha. It's totally enclosed. It's totally enclosed by all of the beings and all of the activities, Shankara says, that those every being is undergoing. And so therefore, the Atma never shines just as it is, just as I am. That requires discrimination. Because for that to happen, what I have to recognize is the me that is changelessly there, no matter what the experience is. And the one, not only that, I am changelessly there, and I'm also the most subtle, because I can't be objectified. Right? Everything else I can, we'll see in the next verse, actually, how they go through this process of objectification.
What do you mean by subtlety?
I'll get into it.
Okay.
But just briefly, because the next verse is going to go into really beautifully for that. I always know everything in my experience, first of all, through my sense perception. So I have instruments that allow for the objectification of these sense objects. If I'm just looking at the sense objects themselves go in an order of subtlety. Like, for instance, the most gross element is earth, because the earth can be perceived by all five sense organs. Right? I can taste it, I can smell it, I can see it, I can touch it, feel it, all of these, I can hear it. But and so it's the most gross. But if I go to the water, I can apply only four sense organs to water, because I can't smell water. Smell belongs to earth. And then if I go to the next one, it's fire. Now I can't taste fire, and I can't smell fire, so now only three sense organs are available for the perception of fire. But if I go one more to air, which is more subtle than the fire, only two sense organs are available. I can touch it, and I can hear it. And if I go to space, the only sense organ that we attribute to space is hearing. Because the only thing that hearing can do is sound. Right? I can hear sound. So space becomes the most subtle of the elements. But now what about your thoughts and your emotions? That's even more subtle, because we're in the subtle realm of a thought. Not a thought that's generated by sense perception, but like an emotion, an imagination. That's even more subtle. But then the one who comments on the thought, that's more subtle. It's innermost. It objectifies, and it's pervasive, and it objectifies. So we keep going all of our experience in order of subtlety. Now we get to myself. Sense organs are not going to objectify me. Right? The five sense organs can't objectify me. The mind also can't objectify me, because the mind itself is illumined. The mind itself is objectified. So it's not, that'll be interesting as we look to how that actually takes place. The mind can't objectify me because it itself is objectified, but it need not objectify me, because are the things that are objectified, this is the viveka that you have to get into, are the things that are actually objectified, do they enjoy the consciousness, or are they themselves illumined? If they enjoyed the consciousness, then the things that objectified would turn around and talk back to you. say hello, and they say hello. That's not the situation. The consciousness itself is that because of which the mind is objectified, the sense organs are objectified, the sense objects are objectified. The fact that they can be objectified is gross, and then that gross, that orders of subtlety go from the most subtle to the most gross in reference to what can actually be experienced. But I am experienced, but I'm not objectified. Consciousness is not objectified. It is self-evident. And so what is more subtle than that, than consciousness itself? Because it can't be known by any of the sense objects. It's not objectified by the mind. It's not objectified by the buddhi. It is differentiated by the buddhi, not objectified. That's a huge difference, you know? Consciousness cannot be objectified. It's also, when we say it's the most subtle, we have two criteria for subtle. One is that it's innermost, and one is that it pervades. These two things. It's innermost and it pervades. Let me just give you, now that we're really getting into it, it's okay. when you say innermost and it pervades, think of it like this. So you have earth is the most gross. Okay? Water pervades the earth. Right? And we can say water is innermost in that it's pervading and it's innermost. Just try to imagine this. Fire pervades the water and heats the water. So fire heats the water, pervades the water, and the hot water pervades the earth. So fire is going to go all the way through. Water will go all the way through to the earth. Fire will go all the way through to the water, to the earth. And then we have air. Air pervades the fire, which pervades the water, which pervades the earth. Then we have space, which pervades the air, which pervades the fire, which pervades the water, which pervades the earth. And then we can say we have the mind using the sense organs. We can go in that route, too. But in the end, when we get to the self, we have conscious being, which pervades everything. From the buddhi, to the manas, to the body, to all of the sense organs. And so, when we go in orders of subtlety, it's not only, it's that which pervades, and that which is innermost. Innermost in reference to it, just to give you a little bit more about innermost, pervasive and innermost. Say if you look at the difference between the types of vrittis that we have, the type of thoughts that we have. We have the buddhi and we have the manas. Just these, take these two. The buddhi is what objectifies the manas. The manas is the fluctuating thoughts, you know, like just the thought flow is manas. Perceptions that just come in. So you're not doing anything with them, they're simply taking place. The negative emotions taking place. The buddhi, which is another type of thought, is innermost because it objectifies and comments upon them. Right? It's not the other way around. Mm-hmm. That's why, even that they're both the antikarana, they both belong to the mind, they're different types of thoughts, but one is innermost to the other. That's why it's kind of a trick, in a way of understanding how the mind works, that in any vritti, any thought modification that you have, it doesn't really matter what it is, the buddhi can come in, can divide that thought modification into subject and object. For instance, say you're having something, the manas, say you're having a negative thought, you're having a negative emotion. And that a negative emotion is associating to another emotion is just building its little web, it's doing its own thing. It's not like there's anybody controlling it, it's just simply doing its thing. Which can be very bad, actually. It can do its thing and go down and down and down and down until you're really down in the dumps. But the buddhi can come in, right, and objectify whatever that emotion is. It can objectify the emotion. Now comes into relationship with it. Just by the simple fact of the buddhi objectifying, the mind objectifying itself, and we have the buddhi. Now that buddhi can comment on it, can come into dialogue with it, can help it, can be useful. But the fact that we have that capacity that the buddhi has that capacity, it is more subtle there, it objectifies, and it's innermost. And so the buddhi is considered more so than the manas, this type of thing. Chitta also is not subtle, really, because the chitta is just the memory. The memories are just things that the buddhi can draw on, or just unconsciously memories can arise. They're functions, but they're not something that are being acted upon. You can act upon them, but they're not acting upon themselves. Right? So then the buddhi gains more subtlety in that way. Right? So we use this idea of innermost and subtle, but pervasion and being innermost, as a way of helping you to differentiate your experience, so that you can get to you, who you are, right? Because you are not somebody who's coming and going. You're admittedly, even for an Ajnani, somebody who is born with self-ignorance, you can't say that you're not always there. It's like it's reminded us that we won't go into deep sleep now, just think in the waking state and the dream state, it's easiest to understand. You're always there. But the experiences that you're having and the points of identification that you're having are definitely not always there. Okay, so that requires some viveka. Who is always there and who isn't? So the one who's not always there is not going to be me. That's going to be a role that I'm playing. One who's always there is going to be me. And so that means that my buddhi needs to be able to perform a very subtle act of differentiation. Why subtle? Because that which is most subtle has to be differentiated. And when we go through this process of what is more subtle, what is more subtle, what is innermost, it is that which is the most subtle that has to be differentiated from absolutely everything else. And so then that requires a buddhi, a mind, an intellect that is capable of doing that differentiation. It's very interesting and easy to differentiate one sense object from another sense object, or one thought from another thought. We're in an objectified realm here. But when we get to the farthest you can go, we're trying to differentiate the one who is not objectifiable to become an object. That one has a different order of reality. It's not going to be, you're not going to be in Maya. You're not going to be within time and space because you're not objectifiable. You know, to be an object within the creation and to partake of this knower known relationship, and yet you are the constant that is always there. So, who cares? Only those few people who all of a sudden realize they really want to know what's going on and who I am and why I'm here. What's my purpose here? And who am I in reference to this body, mind, sense organs, and in reference to the creation, and in reference to God? Okay. To reference to God, if there is one. What is the truth of all of this? And what is my purpose? I mean, most of us remember, you know, when you're little, praying, why am I here? Yeah. Why am I here? What's my purpose? You know, wanting to make some sense out of everything. You had your own questions. I know you all did because you wouldn't be here. That's how it is. So anyway, so let's look at this verse. So it's this Atma, the self, the Purusha, the self, is hidden in all, being hidden in all beings, it doesn't shine as itself, right? Because it's always being experienced by you through the lens of what is objectified. And so it's always experienced by you only through the dresses that you're wearing, like your sense organs and your mind and the physical body, etc. And so you're always being defined, and that being so, there's no way in terms of the experience of all of the objectified, the things that are being objectified actually, that are the dresses that you're wearing, there's no way for you to recognize your own being as non-objectifiable and the one non-dual being, which is the truth of the creation. There's no way that this body, mind, sense organs that can recognize that on its own. Because it's fully identified with the with the self-experience. So then he says, so that being so, he says, drishyate tu, but, so it's not going to shine of its own accord in all of these beings. He says, but it is seen by a buddhi, with a buddhi, which is agriya. Agriya means single-pointed. Mm-hmm. And this is being put in the instrumental singular. Buddhi is feminine. So agriya-ya, right? Time twisted. Buddhya, suchmiya. By a buddhi, which is single-pointed and very subtle. Because if it's not subtle, how can it differentiate? How can it possibly differentiate that which is the most subtle? Right? Even if it has to differentiate the most subtle, even from its objectified self, you know. And so to do that, it can't be engaged in things that are less subtle and less subtle and less subtle and less subtle. It has to have pulled back and want to see the truth of itself, because the buddhi itself is the most subtle in terms of the objectified world. And so it has to be able to differentiate itself from the being that illumines it. So it itself has to be very, very subtle and very single-pointed. It can't be flying all around. It has to be wanting to know the very being that is itself, because there's no other step of objectification. That from the buddhi, from the self to the buddhi, that's it, in a sense. There's the Hiranyagarbha, we'll look at that differently, but from the standpoint of the jiva, what is innermost to the buddhi is really myself. We can do the ahankara, but the ahankara is also put into the buddhi. So he says, with this buddhi that is most subtle and single-pointed, it is seen by the sukshma-darshi bihis. Sukshma-darshi bihis are those seers of the most subtle. There's the seers of the most subtle. Why? How? Because of their buddhi itself being single-pointed and subtle. And so now this gets into the adhikari, who is the qualified student for the knowledge. Because the knowledge requires a mind. It requires your mind in order to gain the knowledge. So in order for the mind to gain this knowledge, it has to be available for it. You know? But who's going to be available for this knowledge? Who cares? Really? Because, say, as long as, which, and this is what, in the realm of normalcy, the world is really divided up into raga dveshas. Raga dveshas are these things I experience, these are good. If I could have this, that would make me happy. If I could have these things, that would make me happy. This is what I want to do. These are the things that I need to accomplish in my life to be a whole, complete person. And these are the dveshas. These are the things that I don't want. These are the things that are obstacles. These are the things that I have to get out of my life or get away from or transform somehow so that I can be happy. So for the normal pursuit of just a human being is, let me have these things so that I can be happy, and let me get rid of these things so that I can be happy, and let me collect them in such a way that in the end I can say, okay, now all is well with me. I've made it. Okay, that's just very simply, basically what it is, you know. And these raga likes and dislikes, you know, and it's basically a like a raga is, I need this, I want this so that I can be happy. That's a desire. The negative form of that desire is, I don't want this so that I can be happy. The whole thing has to do with achieving my happiness somehow. In order for that not to be what is driving you, so to speak, there has to be some recognition. There has to be some major recognition. And that is that these pursuits, they give momentary happiness, but that's all. And we just figure that out over and over and over again until all of a sudden it's one huge figuring out that really matters, it really makes a difference. It makes such a difference that now I say, I really want to understand what's going on. I need to know. because there's really no way that the world, which is by nature always changing, can really give me anything that is lasting. And yet, I know that there is something to be gained. There's something. I know that there's something. We've all experienced it. I know that wholeness of myself. I just don't know when it always slips away. But I still know that it's me. We know. And so it makes you what we call a mumukshu, somebody who really wants to figure all of that out. That becomes what we're doing. And then that allows for the mind then to start pulling back from these raga dveshas, so that they're not primary for us. As we start pulling back, the mind starts to gain shanti, dharma starts becoming more important, start getting more inner space. You know, we start these inquiries, and so the mind starts to transform and change and becomes more subtle, because what my raga dveshas are more subtle, basically, until they resolve. The raga dveshas in the end resolve, but they go through a process of becoming more subtle. It's no longer so much over the sensory data that I'm so interested in. I want dharma, or I want my mind to enjoy certain peace, or I want a certain level of kindness or shanti. I'm working on a totally different level, or the value of values become very important to me, or the qualities of a mumukshu become important to me. Or gaining this knowledge becomes important to me, and I start understanding, you know, all of the qualities of a mumukshu, somebody who desires liberation, and the things that also just take my mind to a lot of pain. I want to change all of that. So that becomes my raga dvesha. Then I have a great raga, a desire for moksha. You know, and that's another painful thing. I want to know now, I don't want to wait anymore. I want it all to happen right now. And that's also very common. We say it's fine. You can have that desire. You can have that desire. That's good. You have that burning desire, because that desire is benign. That's the one benign desire, because that particular desire ends all desire, because it actually takes you to yourself, to the very source of the awareness. It's all right to have that desire. Painful like all of the desires, but it will reward you in the end. Well, all the other desires, are called anala. You know what anala means? Anala is what they call fire. It's a name for fire. Alam means enough. Anala, it's never enough. Mm-hmm. So say you have a fire. It happens at the farm all the time. You have a fire. Okay, I have to put more wood in it. Okay, I have to put more wood in it. Okay, we have to put more wood. I'm in my little room. I'm getting cold. I keep it warm by the wood. So I have to go. Oh, it's getting cold. Okay, I have to put more wood. It's not that the fire says, okay, you've put enough wood in, I'm satisfied. I will start dying. I'll start saying, no, I need more wood. I need more wood. That's desire. It's not like it says, okay, everything's good. Everything's good. No, it never says that. So.
And you have to keep feeding it.
You've got to keep feeding it, yeah. That's kind of the really, one thing you realize is a person starts to really want liberation. When you realize that these desires are endless. Satisfy one, you're just given the shortest amount of time before the next one arises.
It's like an ocean.
What is this? You know, give me a break. There is no break. The desire says no. There's no break.
Yeah.
There's no break. You get
more.
15 seconds. I used to realize that, because it didn't last long at all. A few seconds, it's over. Okay. Okay, I'm going to stop here. We'll do this next, these next few verses. Om swasti prajapya paripalayantam nyayena margena mahim mahishaha go brahmane pya shubhamastu nityam
Loka samasta sukhino bhavantu. Kale varshatu parjanyaha. Prithivi sasya shalini. Desho yam shobarahitaha. Brahmana santu nirbhayaha. Om sarve bhavantu sukhinaha. Sarve santu niramayaha. Sarve bhadrani pashyantu. Ma kaschit dukkha bhak bhavet. Asato ma sadgamaya. Tamaso ma jyotirgamaya. Mrityorma amritam gamaya. Om purnamadah purnamidam purnat purnamudachyate. Purnasya purnamadaya purnameva vashishyate. Om shanti shanti shanti. Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha. Hari Om.